Hi, Happy New Year, everyone. It's great to be with you in a brand new calendar year, 2024. And while we anticipate lots of exciting things in the new year, sometimes it's good just to see some familiar faces. So we, in addition to Caroline today, we've got Dr. Mark Parker, who's going to be joining us and talking about a topic that I think is going to be a really, really big theme for us as a healthcare system in the year 2024. So Caroline, welcome to a new year.
Yeah, this is kind of, it's always nice. You feel like you're starting a little fresh when you get, when you turn the calendar over. I think I was definitely ready to turn the page on 2023. So this is a good start. As we know, new year, but basically the same guidelines for open door, right? We're doing things pretty much the same way. So people who have questions for Mark or Andy, please feel free to put them in the chat. We do have some questions that have come in via email over the past couple weeks, but I think many of us were just focused on spending time with our friends and family, and maybe open door wasn't top of mind. So we don't have a lot of questions. So please, please put those in the chat. We love to hear from you. First and last names, please add your pronouns as well so I get those correct. And that's about it for me for right now. Andy, I know you got a lot to chat about with Mark.
We sure do, and delighted to have Mark with us today. So Mark, why don't we start by just having you tell everyone about your role?
Thank you, Andy. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So I'm the Vice President and Associate Chief Quality Officer for Maine Health. Been in this role now for about 7 years, the most recent to having a system piece to it. Initially, it was purely Maine Medical Center focused. And the areas of oversight are risk management, patient safety, quality reporting, accreditation, infection prevention, patient experience to some degree, and general oversight for our strategy around quality and safety.
Okay, excellent. Now, Mark, what got you interested in healthcare to begin with?
Well, you know, I think I grew up very straight line in my thinking, family influence, wanted to do something professional, interest in the sciences, and so it seemed like a natural thing to want to become a physician. So I think even in grade school, high school ages, I was already thinking a little bit that way. And then in college, that solidified with interest in the sciences. And then more so in those days, a lot of us kind of just plowed straight on through and went to medical school and on to training and the like. I think nowadays what I've seen when I've been on the medical school admissions committee and the like is people do a lot of other things in between. So they jump around a little bit and have some other life experiences. But for me, it was sort of straight through.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Mark, you practiced nephrology for a number of years, and now you're really in a full-time role focused on quality and safety. What sort of inspired that transition for you?
It was no single thing. I came here about almost 25 years ago now. I had been at Lahey Clinic for a few years after my training. Came up to Maine, mostly was in the clinical space at first, got into teaching, led a fellowship program in nephrology for about 15 years. And, you know, we had a lot of work around teaching our fellows about quality improvement and the like. So I had a lot of on-the-job learning. I wasn't really formally trained in quality and safety initially. And then I had the opportunity to be the division director for nephrology for about 9 years. And obviously, when you're in those types of leadership roles, there are a lot of quality and safety issues that come up. So you become more and more familiar with the work. I was very interested in it. And when the opportunity came to apply for a role here, I took it. Still had a lot of on-the-job training to do, did some mid-career training, specialized training, and really loved it since then.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that earlier in your career and earlier in your life, you had a real interest in science. And there's a lot of science behind quality and safety. For sure. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the things you've had to learn to really become an expert in quality?
Yeah. I mean, there is a whole realm of what's called improvement science now, and an actual methodology around how you approach and think about quality. And there are people who study this intently, have studied systems approaches to how to improve. There are a number of people over the years who have been sort of key people who have pushed the field forward. And nowadays, for a lot of us who do this work, there is sort of a formal training process that one can go through to learn those methodologies. And those methodologies for improvement really apply throughout the quality field. So a lot of the things we learn for improvement projects also apply to things we do in safety, things we do in infection prevention and the like.
Yeah, absolutely. So when, you know, I think about leadership, you know, we think a lot of times about what we call the, you know, the hard stuff, which is often referred to as sort of the management things, you know, making sure that the balance, the budget's balanced and making sure we've got rigor in our processes and all of those things. But really, at the end of the day, the most important thing in my mind is often what we refer to as the soft stuff, mm-hmm. which is how do we get along and how do we build trust together and how do we live our value of respect and how do we do those types of things. And I think we kind of have it backwards. I think the soft stuff is really the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And when it comes to management, the, you know, the, what we call the hard stuff is really in some ways the soft stuff. And it's a lot sort of in a similar way with quality and safety, in that there is a lot of science and rigor around some of the things that we know can impact patient outcomes, but how we treat each other and how we engage each other also plays a large role, doesn't it?
Yeah, I remember this, you know, so when I first took this role 7 years ago, I spent a year in an improvement advisor course with the Institute of Healthcare Improvement. It, you know, intermittently, I'd spend a few days in Boston throughout the year and do some project work. And I remember the leaders of the course taught a lot about the psychology of quality improvement and the mindset around working with people, understanding what motivates them, understanding what makes them want to do the work towards improvement, and see it as sort of integrated with everything they do every day. Because right. I think one of the problems I used to encounter years ago, and maybe still to this day in some respects, is that sometimes people see it as sort of an extra, an add-on. That here's my daily job, and oh, I have to go do these quality things on top of that, instead of seeing it as really one. So I think some of the leadership in quality is working around that psychology of how do you really keep it integrated and how do you keep it at a level where people are motivated because it's what, because they feel it's the thing, the important thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we think about our 5-year strategic plan, one of the things that we're motivated around is a goal around becoming a highly reliable organization. And so to that end this year, one of the concepts that we're going to be introducing that you've been a big proponent of is moving to a just culture. Mm-hmm. Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about what that means and what that looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. And first, I want to kind of tie it back to what you just said. So we've been working for several years now around the concept of we truly want to explicitly be a high reliability organization. And I know you've had our chief quality officer on the Open Door before, Omar Hassan, talking about high reliability and what those principles are. And so we really put it into the language of what we talk about every day when we're trying to achieve safety for patients. In concert with that, a couple of years ago, we developed a safety strategy. And that safety strategy was based on something created by the National Patient Safety Foundation almost 10 years ago called Free From Harm. And it was a platform that looked at safety in a variety of domains. And some of those domains included leadership engagement, centralization and coordination of safety care activities like we do in a system, and support for the healthcare workforce, and a measurement strategy around all of that. So we've been thinking about that and thinking about, well, what are our foundational principles? What are the building blocks? And some of those things are the things you've seen in the past couple of years. So we've done a lot of work around positive patient identification, and we've made it a red rule, which means it's highest safety priority in the organization. We've done updated work around universal protocol and timeouts when we do procedures and other interventions with patients. We introduced this past year this cuss tool. You know, we talk about cussing, and really that's about flattening our hierarchy and feeling comfortable, having psychological safety to speak up when we need to. Cuss standing for concerned, uncomfortable, and stop, meaning the steps of escalation if we're in a situation where we think there's potential harm and we need to say something. And in addition to those basic foundational principles, we are now circling back to something called just culture, which is not new. Just culture has been out there in not only in healthcare, but in other industries for several decades now. And it's a concept around when assessing how to analyze an error. In other industries, in the aviation industry, it might be around airline crashes. In the nuclear power industry, it might be around power plant accidents. In our industry, it's about when a harm has come to a patient, or even when a near harm has come to a patient and it didn't happen, but we knew that it identified a situation where there was going to be a potential problem. And decades ago, I think that the culture in many industries was to assign blame, to find out, well, who's at fault here? Who is to blame for this harm? There are several leading people who studied this, and wrote about it, particularly in the 90s and the early part of this century, and took that paradigm and changed it a little bit. And they said, well, there are a lot of things about systems that set us up for errors. It's not always the individual. Most of us don't come to work each day intending to cause a harm. We generally come here wanting to do the right thing and to do our job well and help the people we care for. And so there are a few people. James Reason is one of them. He's a British psychologist who studied error in various industries. And looked at the human factors that went into error. And he concluded that a lot of times, in fact, most of the time when harms occur, it's because there's flaws in our system that set humans up to make mistakes that they don't intend to make. That sort of led to the concept of sort of a blame-free view of errors and mistakes. And that changed the way that we looked at things, not only in other industries, but in healthcare. But then another thinker came along, David Marks. He's an engineer and an attorney. And he said, yes, that's true. And I think we need to think about things that way. But at some level, there's still some personal accountability. We all have a certain degree of competence that's expected of us. And we all work in areas and in systems where we're given a set of criteria that we're expected to work around and work with. And so when you assess an error that has occurred in medicine, you have to look at the entire spectrum. How did the system set somebody up to potentially fail? And what is that person's individual accountability in providing care? And that's what just culture is all about. It's really the intersection of the blame-free environment with an assessment of personal accountability. And that's what we're now turning our attention to when we talk about building our foundational principles, is teaching everyone in the organization, particularly leaders in the organization who often are in charge of assessing error events and figuring out what happened, how to look at that spectrum of potential flaws in the system versus individual accountability in delivering the right kind of care.
Yeah, and so in some ways, this sort of serves, just the concept of just culture serves as a framework to enable us to think about how we manage the aftermath of something that didn't go according to plan. And one of the things that I loved about the way that you've taught this, and a number of senior leaders have had the opportunity now to experience the training around just culture, was really transitioning the mindset to, you know, why did somebody do something wrong, to why was that the best option in the moment, mm-hmm. and really trying to put yourself in that person's shoes to understand what happened and what we can learn from it to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And to your point, there's a range of outcomes from, boy, we had a system failure that set this person up to fail, all the way to, you know, unfortunately, maybe at a time, somebody just did something wrong and malicious with the intent of harming someone. And of course, we don't see that often, but, you know, that's a possible outcome as well. And then everything in between.
Right.
And so it gives us more objectivity around how we handle those issues around the individuals involved. And I think one of the beautiful things about Just Culture is it really does stress supporting those individuals who are involved in an outcome that was unexpected.
Right, right. And the, and so what we're doing in this process then is we're having, you alluded to it, we're now starting to have sessions with a number of people in the organization who have oversight for other people, and teaching them the basic concepts we just talked about, and then providing sort of an algorithm, a way that you could approach an event and analyze an event and try to decide, well, what really went wrong here, doing the root cause analysis, if you will, and including all the system issues that potentially contribute to an event, and assessing the individuals that were involved in the event, the acts that happened, and understanding if there were opportunities to coach individuals to improve as well. So, you know, let's use an example like positive patient identification. You know, we've highlighted this in important ways over the past year or so in the organization. And we still have events that occur every week. Most of them don't lead to actual harm, but we recognize that many of them can lead to harm, right? If you worked in a system or an organization that didn't put a lot of emphasis on this and didn't highlight it every time it came up, it would be part of the culture of that organization to sort of accept that occasionally we make mistakes with identification, or we don't always do that. We're too busy, right? Right. And then if a harm event happened to a patient in that organization, as you analyzed the event, you would say, well, this is a system that doesn't really make it an important part of their culture. That's a flaw of the system. There were human errors that occurred. People didn't want something to go wrong, but they also weren't really trained in that system to think that that's an important barrier to prevent things from going wrong. If you went to another system, like we're trying to be, where you make that a red rule, this is an cultural absolute in our system that we will not accept this, and every time it happens, we're going to try to correct it and improve on it. And you put all the standards in place to teach people and make them aware. Then when somebody does it, then it starts to be a little bit of that person's drift. They work in an organization where they know this is important, and they were particularly busy that day, and maybe they didn't do the two identifiers with somebody and they got it wrong. Then you start to say, well, it's not just our system. This individual needs some coaching. And then you say to yourself, well, is it us? Did we not train them properly? Or did they just, were they a little bit lazy about getting the training or hearing what we said? And so then it starts to become a little bit more of a performance issue in that case, right? And you evaluate it and you manage it the same way you manage any other performance issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So on that note, shifting gears just a little bit, we have really focused on positive patient identification and making that a red rule in the organization. We're actually seeing in some cases, a higher frequency of reports around positive patient identification. Is that a bad thing?
No, of course not. Okay. And obviously the way you pose the question, I think I would assume you probably feel the same way. I think it indicates that we've got a high level of awareness now, yeah. That people, you know, we've advertised a lot, we've talked about it a lot. When events have happened, we've really highlighted them and tried to analyze them. We share them with the rest of the organization. And And so I think we see more reports now because people do understand that this is important and we're trying to improve this, and let's share it every time it happens so that we can learn more and more about how to get better.
Absolutely. And so it's good that people are reporting this so we understand what we can do to get better. And at the same time, if we continue to see it increase indefinitely, then that may not be a good thing. At some point, we do want to start seeing it come down as we continue to heighten awareness, build it into the culture, and make sure that we're always positively identifying the patients we're about to deliver care on. Is hand washing important?
It's another one of our fundamentals. Yeah. You know, we've been doing work around hand washing in recent years as well. And we, in the southern region and at Maine Medical Center in particular, we trialed an electronic monitoring product for tracking and then doing feedback around it. We had some stumbles with that product. There were some problems with the technology. We decided to back away from it now, and we're kind of back to our old-fashioned secret shopper observers of hand washing, and we've continued to do that in all our other local health systems. But that's something that we are highlighting at every opportunity as well. We're trying to give our teams feedback about our compliance with hand hygiene, and we'll continue to make that a high priority over the coming years as we work towards safety in the infection prevention realm.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Mark, great work. You and your team, Just Culture will be one of our big initiatives in 2024. And something that we want to see last for decades, for eons, as we continue to advance our culture around becoming highly reliable as an organization. So thank you for all your efforts on that front. So with that, Caroline, I think maybe it's ready for some questions.
Sounds good. Well, people watching are pretty quiet so far.
Okay.
So bring those questions in. If you're like me, you're kind of doing a little bit of a reentry thing, it's okay. Get those brain waves moving. Let's get some questions. But we do have a couple of email questions, so we'll start there while we're waiting for people watching to put in their questions. And Mark, I know we talked about this one ahead of time a little bit. And you said you would be able to speak to it. Aaron emailed in and said, my colleagues and I are confused about current COVID protocols. We work in a specialty medical office settings and have been told that patients can come in with a COVID positive status at any time during their illness. So the questions that Aaron and the team there have are, why are we still asking the COVID questions if people can come in with COVID? Why is there no mask mandate in place when we're allowing COVID positive patients to come in? And the final question is, why do we need to use our PTO when we are infected with COVID, knowing that we are in an environment where COVID positive patients can come in?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. And I think we're still in a period of transition in terms of the public health view of how we deal with this problem. And consequently, there is a lot of confusion out there. The CDC continues to recommend that when people know they have COVID, and we apply this in the healthcare environment, that they quarantine for 5 days and then they mask for an additional 5 days. And they've been slow to change those recommendations. And so it still carves COVID out as sort of an exceptional respiratory virus, when in fact, in the healthcare setting, in our current mindset, we actually start to think of it as a lot of the other respiratory viruses that we see during this season, same as respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, and influenza, specifically that they are threatening illnesses, particularly for vulnerable people, that they can cause hospitalization, and we see it, but they're also endemic, and COVID in many ways is going to wax and wane like these other viruses over the coming years, and it's now with us all the time to stay. Nonetheless, as I say, we have these CDC recommendations that we need to continue to follow. And we do want to do everything we can in healthcare to protect our patients and keep them safe. And so for our employees, we do need to follow these recommendations closely. In the clinic setting, though, I think there may be a little bit of a misconception about what we're advising. We still want to screen our patients and understand if they may have COVID and if they are at risk of transmitting to people that they encounter when they come into our offices. If we know that that's the case, we do want to escort them, mask them, use our own PPE properly, see them as expeditiously as possible, give them the care they need if they need to be seen, and proceed in that fashion. If there's the possibility that they don't need to be seen at that time, that they're not, you know, that they're mildly ill, and if it's a specialty appointment and it's something that can wait, then we actually do want to reschedule that if possible. So we're not in a phase where we're letting people sort of come and go at will. We are still very cautious about it. And we do need to follow these guidelines for our own staff and follow the quarantine and masking guidelines, because that is still the guidance at the moment from the CDC.
Yeah, and Mark, I think what you've referenced is there is some discretion at the clinic level around the clinical appropriateness of seeing a patient who might happen to have COVID
Correct.
That day, and if it's something that's relatively elective or non-urgent. The ideal circumstances that patient be, you know, requested to reschedule at a
Correct.
Time where they're better, but there may be a need to see that patient, and that's what we're here for as healthcare professionals, is to help those patients when they're sick. And there's a reality that this is going to continue, I think, to be a fluid situation. We have seen a significant increase both in the number of the degree of COVID transmission in our communities, as measured by wastewater samples, and we've had the largest number of COVID patients in our hospitals. In quite some time here recently. And so a number of other health systems have updated recommendations, including some that have gone back to masking of those who are delivering care to patients. And so we'll probably continue to evaluate that and potentially update guidance as we continue to monitor the situation and try to understand what this is going to look like in the states of Maine and New Hampshire.
We have a question from Kimberly that came in saying that she's seeing a system breakdown when patients are seen in hospital ED departments and then a referral is entered into Epic. She said physicians will order a referral, but then it doesn't go anywhere in the Epic system so that the patient's seen at a primary care office or a specialty office to be processed. The patients think that the referral is being processed and they are expecting a call, but then the referral doesn't go into any work queue, so it's never seen to process and the patient never gets scheduled. Is there anything we can do about this?
Yeah, and Kimberly, thanks for bringing this to our attention, and for sure, thank you for bringing it here, but also I hope you've raised this back in your unit, wherever you're working, so we can try to get this addressed if in fact that is an issue. And so we think about referring patients really as a safety issue. To make sure that they get the care they need and the loop is closed on that. And we have a lot of processes to kind of monitor that. Some of those are technical processes. Some of those are people processes. And so if there's a breakdown, we certainly want to understand that. Mark, I don't know if there's anything that you want to add.
No, I think you made it clear.
As well.
All right, we just have a couple questions left in email. So again, if you're watching, you got a question, please put that in the Q&A. Ben wanted to know how Maine Health goes about handling patient reviews about providers that are not good. Is there a certain amount of rapport that patients need to have, or a certain number of reviews for there to be corrective action?
Mark, you do a lot of patient experience work. Is this something you might want to answer?
Yeah, I can take a shot at that one, Andy. Okay. So in our patient experience program, we have patient surveys, patient reviews that are done through something called NRC, the National Research Corporation. And one of those methodologies is called real-time surveys. So as you're probably aware, many of our patients are surveyed within 24 to 48 hours after a healthcare encounter. And we compile that information in aggregate to sort of see the trends of how our patients are perceiving the care, but also to give feedback to individuals. In the ambulatory care setting, individual providers do see those surveys and see that feedback, and then practice leadership review those periodically. I think like anything else that has to do with performance, when we as leaders or practice leaders in this case review this type of information, we want to see sort of the full body of information, right? There are always going to be individuals who are dissatisfied And that doesn't necessarily reflect on the competence, skill, or empathy of the provider. But when we see a number of reports that are sort of all in a similar theme, then that starts to raise a flag about performance. I wouldn't say that there's any single number that or threshold that triggers an evaluation by a supervisor of an individual provider. I think it's probably more the overall themes that are happening over time in the context of how many times something is reported, or on rare occasion, maybe something that is highlighted because the comments seem fairly extreme. In the emergency department setting, I think that's a pressure cooker environment where we see a lot more range in terms of the types of comments that are made. And I think in that context, we really want to see a good volume of information before we would sort of make a judgment about, well, there really is a performance issue here or not. So to go back to Ben's question, I don't think there's an absolute number, but I think these reports do go back to practice leadership. And I think it's the volume of information over time that helps determine whether something's gonna rise to the level of, hey, let's have a discussion about this.
All right, we've got one more question that came in the email from Lily, and Lily wanted to know if there was any discussion or planning around having various consent forms that are available in multiple languages. Can we expect that to roll out soon? She's thinking the fact that we're doing asking about preferred written language for people, that perhaps that could be coming.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate that question. And we want to continue to create a more inclusive environment for the care of our patients. And so the consent to treat forms that we use across our system have been adopted to the five most commonly used languages within our system. And I think there are plans to continue to expand that in the future. There may be some very specialized consent forms for specific procedures that have not been translated yet. And so I suspect as we continue to become more inclusive and understand the importance of equitable care, that's an effort that will continue well into the future.
So we did get a question in the chat. The question is, it says, new hires have a formal check-in with a person that they directly report to within the first couple months as part of standard onboarding. When the hire is in a supervisory role, is there a team check-in that occurs also with all that retention work going on? It seems like this could be a great added benefit to ensure feedback at all levels is incorporated in the check-in back to the person that the new employee reports to.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I don't know that I have a specific answer for that. I don't know, but I will check with Scott Ballard, our Chief People Officer, to understand sort of what the expectations are for new leaders to receive that feedback from the team that they're leading. We want to create an environment where it's easy to give feedback and to do it in a respectful and supportive way. And so I love that idea.
Yeah, it seems like it would be nice to have a good sense from your team on how you're doing. I think everybody wants to know on both ways,
absolutely,
right, how that's going. All right, that's what we have for questions. The good news is I feel like while people maybe didn't have a lot of questions, they really were feeling that giving spirit because we have got a whole bunch of really, really nice recognitions. And I know on the last program, we told people, please send them in to askandy@mainhealth.org. And we did get some. And we also want to start with you, Mark. Thanks for being with us. And I know that you have a recognition that you want to start with.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. I wanted to acknowledge the team I'm working with of leaders across the health system in quality and safety. And some of the pictures are here. In the upper left, you can see Omar Hassan, our Chief Quality Officer. And then all the people who are leading, I won't name them, but all the people who are leading quality and safety at our individual organizations, some of whom I had to put some names in because I had a trouble finding their pictures. But we've been working together closely now for several years. And we, and particularly in this past year, we've really been working on restructuring our quality and safety enterprise and standardizing the things that we do in quality and safety and really getting in lockstep to do that so that no matter what your organization you're at Maine Health, you're going to see a consistent approach to how we think about quality and safety, including some of the programs we talked about here today. So I just want to acknowledge these colleagues and thank them very much for their partnership.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible team, isn't it? Yeah, we're very, very fortunate. So, Mark, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for all that you and the quality and safety team do to help us become a reliable organization that provides really great care to our patients.
I appreciate it.
And we've got some additional great recognitions today. And so we're going to start with the Midcoast Parkview Health Patient Access Team. And so the Midcoast Patient Access Central Registration Team chose to celebrate the holiday season by selling candy canes, raising funds to purchase gifts for Maine children. Through word of mouth, the team collected donations from care team members across Midcoast Parkview Health, totaling over $700. These funds allowed the team to purchase these gifts supporting local families. So thanks to this team for the work, for working together to keep the children in our communities warm and to bring joy to those in need. Your efforts made a profound positive impact, supporting our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. In addition to that, I want to tell you about a fantastic Kaizen event that occurred. So in early December, a group of clinical, operational, and IT leaders participated in a five-day, highly focused meeting, or Kaizen event, aimed at improving the in-basket within Epic. So care team members expressed the need for improvements within Epic's in-basket in the 2023 class survey results. The Kaizen event provided a rigorous structured process to create a solid action plan that addresses the feedback and needs of our care team members. As a result, multiple changes are being implemented that will improve optimization in many areas, including universal standard and workflows, internal provider-to-provider communication, and result management. Based on earlier work done by the Maine Health Medical Group in-basket work group in collaboration with Epic, more than 13 million outdated in-basket messages are being removed from users' in-baskets. I know that's a big relief for a lot of people. So congrats to everyone involved for working together to tackle a pain point and develop a positive change for so many. This next kudo was submitted by Brad Gallant, who says, you know, thanks to Dr. Berknes of Maine Medical Partners Neurosurgery and Spine and Dr. Braun of Maine Medical Partners Orthopedics for providing compassionate care and reassuring our 14-year-old daughter leading up to and following spinal surgery for scoliosis. The amount of time they spent with us was amazing, and there was no doubt that they would care for our daughter as if she was their own. After extensively researching this procedure, I realized how fortunate we are to have the two of them team up and provide this amazing service locally. And boy, we are fortunate here to have our neurosurgery and orthopedics teams. They are just absolutely fantastic. And that was just an incredible kudo. So thanks to that entire team for all the care they provided to that patient. And then we also have patient experience recognition for Dr. Melissa Streeter from Midcoast Medical Group Women's Health. Dr. Streeter's care far exceeded my expectations. She is kind, professional, intelligent, and compassionate. She asks the right questions and explains complicated medical procedures in a way I can understand. She never belittles questions, but instead welcomes them. I left feeling better informed and in good hands. She is an amazing human and a treasure in our community. So thank you for delivering excellence in patient-centered care, Dr. Streeter. That communication with patients is so important. So thank you for that. I also had the opportunity yesterday to speak to some of the leaders of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital about some of the work they're doing in OPEX and really using that to make improvements in how they're delivering care and also really engaging their teams. Really fantastic. So congratulations to that team as well. All right, next open door is January 17th. And until then, make sure you're positively identifying the patient in front of you and then washing your hands before engaging in care. Hope everyone has a great week and we'll see you on January 17th.